Hello and welcome to the Worn and Wound podcast. My name is Blake Bettner, and I am in studio today in Brooklyn, joined by our super producer, Josh. Josh, how you doing?
Doing good, man. How are you?
Awesome. And we've got Zach Kazan in the computer there. Zach, how are you? Welcome.
Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks, Blake.
And I'm thrilled about our guest today. He is, I don't even know how to describe him. You know him as NYC Watch Guy on Instagram. Welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I don't think anyone has not known how to describe me before, but I'll take it. Hopefully I'm doing things the right way if people can't even figure out how to describe me.
Yes,
your blog calls you a degenerate watch collector based on the greatest thing. So I think that's a pretty good description, probably.
that's not bad. I'm also the biggest basketball fan in the world. So I basically oscillate between basketball and watches. That's pretty much my entire life.
All right. So we have to start with the most important thing here. Any thoughts on Giannis becoming the latest squad member for Breitling?
Man, he loves watches. So I have a funny story. I was at a Hawks-Bucks game probably about 2 or 3 years ago. At halftime, we're in the owner's box, and the owner of the Bucks walks in. And somehow the conversation gets to talking about Giannis because he was coming up for probably a contract extension or something. And everyone was like, well, of course you're going to give him the max contract. What is there to even talk about? And he goes and he says, Giannis likes watches. He came up to me the other day. I was wearing a Patek and he looked at me and he goes, I like watch. You give me watch. We sign contract.
Look at that.
So I think he's got a soft spot for watches. I heard he was part of the watch box investment as well. So it sounds like he's making his rounds in the watch world. I think a guy like him, he's more of a man of the people, right? I think Breitling is probably the right move for a guy like that. That's a little bit more mass market as opposed to having gone with an APRM Patek. Like, I think not that Patek does anything with anyone, I guess, but if we talk APRM and some of the more high-end brands, I think Giannis has always been like this really humble guy who came from nothing in Greece, and him and his brothers all have won championships. Like, it's such a great story. So I'm happy for Breitling, happy for him. Hope he makes a shit ton of money.
Yeah, definitely. All right, let's jump over to a wrist check. Zach Kazan, what are you wearing?
I'm wearing my Grand Seiko SPGA 469 today.
Beautiful. This is your latest pickup, yeah?
Yes, yeah. This is the one I picked up at the end of last year. Still really enjoying it, wearing it a lot.
So, yeah, I like those watches. I have problems remembering what they are based on just those letters and numbers.
Same. I don't know. If you spit a reference number at me for a Grand Seiko that I don't own, I will have no idea.
Josh, what are you wearing over there?
I have a Seiko Recraft SNK N01, I think.
Right, yeah. Cool. Yeah. I'm wearing my Ming Messina Lab honey something or other.
Nice.
The black.
Are the hands aligned?
The hands are aligned, yes. I'm one of the lucky ones, so I'll take it. All right, NYC Watch Guy, what do you got on your wrist?
I am wearing an Urwerk 220 carbon, but it's a very special version of it. It's one of 23 pieces that Michael Jordan had made for him and his buddies. And it was a year-long saga of trying to get one. And I'm happy to say that the stars aligned about a month ago. Right person, right place, right time. Favor called in. And a couple days later, I picked up what for me is the holy grail of watches, because I've always been an independent guy, big fan of Urwerk, and obviously the biggest basketball fan in the world, diehard Jordan fan, like grew up on Michael and worship him like a god. And so when I found out that this watch existed in the world and that my two biggest loves in the world had collided, I said, well, I got to find a way to get this watch. And it's a long story that we can talk about over beer sometime.
Yeah.
But I basically said this was my end game watch, and it kind of is. It doesn't mean that I won't ever buy another watch again. I bought one like 3 weeks after I got this one, because when AP calls to tell you you've got the new titanium perpetual in, you buy it. But
yeah.
I think the way I explained this to a lot of the people who were worried that I was actually quitting the hobby entirely was I said, no, I'm not going to stop buying watches, but I don't believe that there will ever be a watch that means more than this one to me. There will be great watches. They will be mechanically superior. They will be aesthetically superior. But when it comes down to the meaning of a watch for me, the fact that the two things that I spend almost all of my life on, basketball and watches, coming together to be this one watch, and for me to have gotten one when it was basically unobtainium, they were never on the market, they were never sold to anyone, was a pretty big deal. So that was that's the awesome. Pinnacle Congrats. Of my collecting journey for me.
Yeah, congratulations. That's super cool. I know that Michael Jordan has been he's been a watch guy for a long time and an Erwerk guy. I feel like he's been pictured for ages, even some of their early models, 103s, I think, yep. is from what I remember.
Yep.
But the picture that always that I think of when somebody mentions Michael Jordan and watches is the picture of him courtside in, like, of course, a really baggy suit and the datograph on the Longa bracelet. Yep.
Correct.
And, of course, like, he's a big guy, of course, you know, and it just, like, looks pretty small. I think the original datograph is like 39 millimeters or something like this. but anyways, I mean, that's not like, especially back then, that's not a watch that you just like, oh, I got some money, I'll walk into wherever and buy it. Like, that you're a watch person if you've got that watch, right?
Yeah, no, Mike is absolutely 100% a watch guy. Like, I didn't know that. I mean, I thought I knew everything about Michael Jordan. To a creepy extent, like, you know, birthdays and anniversaries and, you know, divorce dates and all that shit. I'm on top of all of it. I never realized how big of a watch guy he was until I'd say a couple of years ago when I started to spot the Erwerk pictures. Cause, you know, you see him with a Plutona and you're just like, ah, whatever. Like, every athlete's going to buy a Daytona at some point, and platinum for Michael, like, makes sense. And so you saw him with a lot of the mainstream watches and you didn't know whether he's a watch guy or whether he just buys expensive watches. And then there was an auction at this really shitty little auction house called Leland's that does sports memorabilia about a year and a half ago, where if you guys watched The Last Dance, which I'm sure everyone did, the security guard of his, the guy who, like, you know, plays him in quarters and shrugs his shoulders.
Yeah.
So that guy, I'm forgetting his name now. Michael gave him a shit ton of stuff over the years. And one of the things that he gave him was a Rolex Datejust that had in the back an inscription, you know, Merry Christmas from MJ. And it was like December 25th, 1993.
Wow.
So this thing comes up for auction. I go, all right, of course I'm going to, like, this is the watch. I'm buying this for sure. Even though I don't wear any Rolexes ever, I said, this watch I have to own. And so it turns out the way auctions work in the sports memorabilia world, which is not at all the way things work in the watch world, is that at the time, these are all online auctions. And when at the time that the auction ends, it goes into something called extended bidding, apparently, right? So the auction doesn't actually end when the auction ends. It goes into extended bidding where every time someone places a bid, the clock resets for 30 minutes. And so anybody has another 30 minutes to bid. So you could technically go on forever.
Yeah.
And so I didn't know any of this. I've never bid at one of these auctions. But the worst part is, in order to bid in extended bidding, you needed to have gotten a bid in during the 30 days that the auction was running.
Uh-huh.
I, not realizing any of these rules, am sitting there waiting to bid at like the last minute, the way any watch guy does to snipe an auction.
Yeah.
And so I get to like a minute left, and it turns out you needed to have been pre-registered. They needed to have verification of your income. I was just like, you've got to be shitting me right now. But oh, I'm saying, okay, no big deal. I'll call them, I'll get verified, and I'll still bid in extended bidding. Well, turns out if you didn't place a bid during the first top period, you can't place a bid during extended bidding. So I lost the watch, and the damn thing went for nothing. It went for like $13,000.
Oh, wow.
I was so upset. But those were the little tidbits that I started to realize, like, Mike is a serious, serious watch guy.
Yeah.
And then, of course, anyone who's buying Erwerks, anyone who's buying Langas on platinum bracelets, and then anyone who's, you know, doing a limited edition Erwerk, like, you know, this guy is serious about him. I've heard he's got over 500 watches in the collection.
Oh, wow.
So he's serious.
And again, I mean, seeing the watches that he has, it's not just I've got money and this is what people with money get. Stuff like flashy watches, like the watches that he has, show that he clearly thinks about this stuff and cares about it and has an interest in it, from the Longas to the Erwerks, yep. Which I think is pretty cool. So no, that's awesome. So you just mentioned you don't wear a lot of Rolexes. We're in kind of a weird stage right now with I guess collecting in general, or watch buying, watch accumulating, watch speculating. So you just recently started your own. What is it called? Is it a blog, the Medium, your own Medium channel?
It's a Medium page. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know if I'd call it a blog, but it's just a collection of my thoughts about the industry that, you know, once every 2 weeks or 3 weeks when I'm sitting around on a Sunday evening with nothing to do, yeah, I decide to write about it. And usually it stems from, you know, some conversation that I probably had with a fellow collector or an Instagram post or something that happened that triggers a thought for me. And I like to talk a lot about the culmination of the business side, the passion side, the watches, the brands, all the players in between. Like, you know, the business of watches fascinates me because we're living in an unbelievable bull market run here for the watch industry. I don't think anyone in their wildest minds thought that this is what it was going to look like, frankly, in the middle of a pandemic that we're still in. It's a fascinating time. We're seeing this across crypto. You're seeing it across NFTs. You're seeing it across almost every collectible category, quite frankly. Trading cards had a huge boom. Ticket stubs now. And so it's this rising tide lifts all ships. Like, I don't think it's just the watch market. I think the watch market was on its way anyway. I think it's taken on a complete life of its own. But you're seeing this swell of money that is coming from God, like, I mean, most of it's crypto gains, for sure, that is driving so much of this market. And so, you know, I like to think about these things and put out some economic theories about some of them, and maybe they're right, maybe they're wrong. Thankfully, nobody really cares what I have to say. So
no, they're very entertaining to read. You know, and I think they kind of capture the, you know, the zeitgeist at the moment of what people are wondering about. And I think there's a kind of a strange convergence of new people into the hobby, because there's a lot of new people with a lot of money kind of coming in to the hobby with interacting with people that have like been here for a really long time and have been buying watches for a really long time and don't really think about watches like that, but they're kind of starting to be forced to think about their watches like that. Is there like an unhealthy relationship going on here with people who are getting into it, mixing with people who are like, well, you know, I don't want to have to think about, like, here's watches that I want to add to my collection because I want to keep them for the long haul because I enjoy wearing them. I understand the brand. I know the movements. I know their history. I know all this kind of stuff. But now I'm kind of like competing with this other group of people for the watches that I want to buy. And they're kind of pushing all these other people out of the market, you know, which is a rough spot to be in. For people like me.
No, it's 100% true. I think there's people that knew nothing about watches, and there's like peers of mine, and then there's extremely wealthy investors of mine that, you know, are worth billions of dollars, and none of these people cared about watches until a year ago or 2 years ago. And now all of a sudden I get phone call, like when the Tiffany blue dial whatever 5711 came out a month ago, the number of phone calls I got from people who thought I could get them this watch, I was like, are you people out of your mind? Like, why do you think I can get you one? And they're like, well, you're the watch guy, right? You know everybody. Like, it's like, dude, first of all, some of these people who called me could have afforded to just buy Tiffany themselves. I was like, just buy the company and then maybe get me an allocation while you're at it, because yeah, I can't help you. And so it's becoming part of it. I always hope that some of it is true passion for watches, and that's why some people are getting into it. But, you know, the pessimist in me says, as with everything, we live in a capitalist society where we look to make money on absolutely everything, and that 90%+ of the people who are entering the watch market today are entering it purely with dollar signs in their eyes. They're playing games. They're coming in. They're making up bullshit stories that happened to them. They're emailing the headquarters and saying, oh, your salesperson mistreated me, all in the hopes to try to get a watch out of them. Mm-hmm. Like, it's really, honestly, I've become extremely disenchanted with the watch world over the last 6 months or so, as I've heard so many of these stories, and I've seen it go from what was really a passionate group of people that for the last 10 years, there was no money to be made on any of these things other than, you know, the odd Tiffany stamped Nautilus, great. Like, other than that and some really rare unique pieces, there was no money to be made. I was buying these things at 60 off retail, and when I wanted to move them, I couldn't even move them at 60 off. I'd have to, you know, I'd have to sell them at 65 off. That was the world we were in, and we were buying them because we truly enjoyed what watches represented. To me, it was a world before the digital era of staring at your screen all the time. The fact that there was this mechanical device on your wrist, and it was art. And today, unfortunately, I've just come to the point where everybody, the only thing anyone talks about is, you know, what is the price of this thing on the secondary market? And, you know, what sexual act do you have to perform to get access to one at retail? And it's just, it's gotten disgusting, to be quite frank.
It's just hype piece after hype piece. We just move from one.
Everything's
one
a
to
hype
the next.
Piece today.
Yeah.
What isn't a hype piece?
Yeah. So is this what has kind of moved your collecting away from the Rolexes and Pateks of the world and more into the independent end?
No, I've never bought a Rolex. I never will. I had a very strange journey through the watch world. Most people start with Rolex, right, and then they move up to Patek and AP, and then they eventually discover the independents when they realize they're bored of the mainstream brands. For me, it started the complete opposite way. I mean, my first watch was a Zenith, which, fine, that's a mainstream brand, but it wasn't a Rolex. It wasn't one of the things that most people would wear as a flex. I just really liked the way the Zenith El Primero looked, and I bought one. And then, like, my fourth or fifth watch after that was an FP Journe Chronometer Blue. So, like, I jumped deep into the independence almost immediately. And following the Journe, I bought an MBNF LM101, and then I bought a Caribou de Lénine. And so, like, I went the complete opposite path where I said, I don't like Patek, I don't like AP, I hated RM. Like, I didn't want anything that everyone else had. I wanted the stuff that was special and that really made a difference to the people who we were buying them from, yeah, as opposed to these large conglomerates. And it was only, I think, 5-7 years into my collecting journey that I came back around and I bought my first Patek, which was the 5170P. I bought my first AP, which was the Pride of Italy chronograph. I bought my first RM. And so it was exactly the opposite path for me that most people take in the journey, which I think has been an interesting, way to go about collecting. I don't know whether it was right or wrong. I don't know whether I kind of missed out on the journey that everyone else takes to buy some of those more mainstream products. But for me, I've always been intrigued by the special stuff and the ones where they're only making 30 pieces, 40 pieces a year.
Yeah.
And so that's just where I'm at. And I'll always be an independent guy, but I've sprinkled in, I mean, AP, I love AP, even though for me, it was an acquired taste early on and I didn't like them until I liked them. Now I love AP and I'm a huge fan of the Royal Oak and I have several and I wear them all the time, but my heart still lies with the independents, mm-hmm, where, you know, I know that they're taking risks. Like the stuff that Max does at MBNF and the stuff that Erwerg does, like you look at this watch and you're just like, holy shit. Like, how do you even come up with something like that versus, you know, every Rolex is basically the same watch with a different colored dial and a different, you know, bracelet or strap. And it's just not interesting.
Yeah. They're good at doing their thing and it is what it is. And, Max, we had Max on the podcast here, a little while ago and it was interesting to kind of hear the journey. It's really fascinating. The journey that brand has been on and some of the ups and downs and how, well, I guess just recently here within the past year, like the kind of, you know, how things, the fortunes, I guess you could say, have changed. And I'm really happy because these are a lot of really awesome people. Like if you know Max, he's an incredible person. Guys like Tim and Bart Groenfeld are amazing people. And you get to know some of these people in the process of getting into their watches, right? Which is pretty cool. And I think more people should appreciate this kind of stuff. But on the flip side, like the Groenfelds just recently stopped taking orders for their watches because they become so full. Their entry level Principia are going up and up and up on the second hand. So I feel like there's people who have been into that space, who've been into that stuff for a really long time, and now it's just becoming like further and further away from them, which is kind of a bummer, you know.
It is. You know, I say to people all the time, I say money aside, I understand there's a lot of us that were young in the hobby. I didn't have any money 10 years ago to buy a watch, like zero. I couldn't spend a dollar on something this frivolous. I've been lucky that I've done well over the course of my career, and now I can afford to buy a couple watches a year and not worry about them. So money aside, I say if 3 years ago you were not willing to buy one of these watches, then my question to you is, why are you willing to buy one today? And to me, the answer solely is you're looking at it as an investment and you think it's going to go up, because these things were available. Like the Groenfeld Remontoirs were sitting for literally like $28,000 to $30,000. Today they're $100,000 watch, but they were available anytime you wanted them for $30,000, and nobody wanted to buy them until they got hot. And you see that over and over and over again. We've seen it with the mainstream brands like Patek and AP. I remember when you could walk in and buy a jumbo and they were offering you a discount, and it was not that long ago. It was 4 to 5 years ago. I still have pictures in my phone from walking into a boutique. And today you'll buy any AP they offer you because you go, well, I want to get the big piece because I know that thing's going to be worth a couple hundred grand on the retail market, on the resale market. Like, that's the problem, is everybody's looking at this from that lens. And look, you can't blame anyone. We live in a capitalist society where we're just trained to do that. And the more and more and more people that are entering this, I can't even call it the hobby anymore. I call it the market. Like, these people are entering the market. They're not entering the hobby. We were in the hobby 10 years ago. Today, they're entering the market. And the amount of money that is entering this market today simply means to me that these prices, as absurd as they look on the secondary markets today, they're only going to keep going higher. There's no reason why that market's going to crash if you're just in the second innings of people entering this market.
Yeah, it's a bummer. I remember 2017, I was with StockX, actually. And when we launched the watch part of that business, I remember one of the first listings, I think I've told the story on this podcast before, but one of the first listings we got was from one of the longtime sneaker users of the site. And he put a CB on, a Jordan CB. Wow. And that told me, like, right off the bat, oh, there's more crossover here than I ever imagined. Like, there's some people that are living in both of these worlds for sure. I think he listed it at like 19.5, 22, something like this. And as at that time, I mean, I certainly didn't have that kind of money, but I remember like telling my dad, you should buy this watch. This is a really nice watch. You know, of course, now I think they're 100, 110 or whatever.
Yeah.
Ridiculousness. But yeah, it's a problem. And it was the same with Datagraphs back then too. I mean, you get them for 35, 40 grand. A very different world now. And, you know, and like I said, on one hand, like, these are watches, well, the Datagraph, I will say, like, that's a watch that deserves to be priced probably like where it is right now. The CB, I don't know. but I do like the watch. So you think this is just the world that we live in? This is what we're going to have to get used to, like it or not?
I think so. I mean, right. I mean, look at the sneaker market, right? It's a different standard deviation away in terms of price point. Right? You're talking about $125 sneakers that sell for 500, 700, 2000, 3000. Here with watches, we're talking about $100,000 watch that sells for 300,000. Like, when you look at the multiple, actually, the watch market is extremely underpriced, in my opinion. And I have this economic theory that I've been shouting from the rooftops to anyone who will listen, hoping that maybe, you know, someone will give me a Nobel Prize for it. But my theory is that items that have utility or a retail price will never go up in value nearly as much as items that don't have either of those things. So when you think about a watch, you know, one, it had utility at some point, but more importantly, even if today we make the argument there's no utility to a watch because we have an iPhone to tell time, there is a retail price for every single watch out there. And when there is a retail price, I believe that as humans, we have this mental block from being able to pay more than a certain times that number. Right, so when you look at like the AP Black Ceramic Perpetual, in my opinion, that is the hottest watch on the market. I think anyone will literally give up their left nut for one of those watches today. It only trades for like 3 times retail. That's, to me, insane, because it's unobtainium. There's just no way to get one.
Yeah.
But why does it trade for only 3 times retail? I think it's because we as humans have this mental block that we're not going to pay more than that. But you look at a baseball card or basketball card, right? It has no utility. It comes in a pack that has no retail price. The price of a pack is like $4. So it's basically zero. You're ripping open a pack, you pull out a basketball card, and if it's a one-of-one Luka Doncic rookie card with his autograph, that thing sells for $5 million the next day. That's an insane amount of money to pay for a piece of cardboard, but it's because there's no reference point, right? And so we're willing to pay whatever we think something's worth. And so I've sort of been looking at every market things that have utility, things that have a retail price. And so when you look at the NFT market, which everyone is talking about these days, right, you see things like the CryptoPunks and the Apes that have sold for millions of dollars. Mm-hmm. And everyone's going, well, NFTs are stupid. There's no utility to them. So everyone's like, oh, we should make a utility-based NFT. Well, if you make a utility-based NFT, if it has a certain, let's say the utility is that it gets you into a restaurant, because this is a real world example. There's actually a restaurant in Manhattan now that has sold NFTs as membership. So owning that NFT gets you access to the restaurant, and then you can flip that membership to someone else on OpenSea if you want to.
Yeah.
Well, in my mind, access to a restaurant has a ceiling, and that ceiling is pretty low, right? It's not worth $1 million to anyone to get access to a restaurant. So that NFT, in my opinion, is never going to trade for more than a couple thousand dollars, because that's the cap that we as humans are going to put on the intrinsic value of something that gives you utility. So it's a fascinating, you know, sort of economic theory of looking at all these things that are now rising in value. And so when I look at watches in particular, I actually think they're underpriced on the secondary market relative to other asset classes, such as trading cards and art, and whatnot. So, and that's because I think watches have a retail price.
So you talk about NFTs, and you've got, you detail in a couple of posts on your Medium ways that watch brands might put these to practical use, that aren't just, you know, I don't even know what you'd call whatever they are now.
Not just JPEGs.
Not just JPEGs, right? But like, as a meaningful way to like assign ownership of this thing. I saw StockX just started doing something similar this week or
yesterday.
Last week. Yeah, I was getting texts from friends there about this. Like the so you can sell the NFT, and they will store the shoe that it's associated with in their warehouse, their vault, or whatever they're calling it. So you're saying, you know, as far as like the warranty, the box and papers, all of this stuff that would go with a watch could theoretically be in NFT form. Forget about all that other fancy stuff. You still get the watch, and then you own the NFT along with it. And you even talked about where every time it changed hands could potentially like result in a percentage of that sale going to the brand that sold the watch in the first place. Which is pretty interesting, I thought.
Yeah. Look, the NFT world opens up a massive opportunity for creators, right? And to me, watch brands are creators. That's essentially what they are, at least the independents, the conglomerates, whatever. But, you know, for me, Max is a creator and the Groenfeld brothers are creators. And these guys being able to monetize and take advantage of the resale market being where it's at is an interesting idea. Now, consumers may say, that, like, I'm buying this and if it's my property and when I sell it, you know, I'm keeping all the money. What an NFT though would be able to do in this scenario is it would sort of act as the certificate of authenticity that can be held on the blockchain in a wallet. And every time the watch is sold, if you essentially don't also receive that NFT, it's like buying a watch without the papers. And everybody knows, like, you don't do that if the papers are available. Mm-hmm. And you always question, why are the papers not available? Like, is this a stolen watch? What happened? And so the difference though is papers can be faked very easily, a little bit harder to fake an NFT on the blockchain. But more importantly, you now start to create a chain of custody to track the provenance of every item in the world from the time it was manufactured, to which distributor it went to which retailer it went to, when it was sold, who bought it. You don't have to know the actual name of the person. You would simply know that there's this crypto wallet address that exists that held that NFT. And then when that person sold it, once again, like, the beauty of the blockchain is all the data is public. So anybody should be able to essentially run a query to find all this information out. Now, that sounds like utopia to me as a collector who wants to know exactly where every watch has been and how long it was held for and when it was flipped. That sounds great. The problem, I believe, is that I don't think most watch brands want that level of data out there, because now you start to understand how many watches are they producing. Yeah. Where are they being shipped to? How often are they being flipped? I'm certain that many watch brands supply the gray market themselves. I know this for a fact, right? They definitely don't want that news out there. Yeah. So the amount of transparency that the blockchain would provide, if this were implemented as a true open blockchain protocol, it's to the point where I don't think any luxury brand would ever take on that level of liability, in their minds, liability. For us, it's great, but I don't think that they want all that data out there. And so that's why my my whole article was saying, here's how we can solve so many of the problems. Like, every brand bitches about people coming in and buying watches to flip. Like, okay, you want to solve that problem, have an NFT with it, because you're going to know the second that thing sells. Yeah. And by the way, you could build in a royalty stream into the smart contract that said, in a perfect world, if the person paid through crypto, that some portion of that would be sent back to the brand. So there's benefits to them, but I believe that the benefits are outweighed by the potential issues with all of their dirty laundry being aired in public within the watch world. And I don't think any of them want that. So I don't know that we're ever going to get there.
Yeah. Do you think it's just a matter of time though, like before some of these technologies evolve to the point of, that's just inevitably going to kind of intersect with what we do? I mean, when I, or some of the independent brands, I have an Erwork as well. And when you go into their site, there's like an owner's club and you can go and put in your, the number on the certificate and where it was bought. You put in all this kind of information, then it gives you access to like the owner's room or club or whatever it is that you go in there and discuss.
The difference there is that is a centrally held database that the brand controls, right? So nobody can actually query that data. It's all a black box that the brand controls, which for them, it's brilliant. Like AP does this, right? AP says, come register your watch. Jorn does this, come register your watch, because they say, if you register your watch, one, we'll give you more warranty. Sometimes they like extend your warranty. But two, they say, hey, we'll give you credit for owning our stuff. Like Jorn, I think, has done the best job of this, where they say, look, we don't care where you bought your stuff. If you bought all your watches from Watchbox, that's fine. Yeah. Come register them with us so that we know what you own. And then that will help your profile in getting new stuff from us, which is, to me, a fine way of doing things. It also lets them know exactly who has what, more importantly. But it's all private data that Jorn now controls. The beauty of the blockchain would be that all collectors and everyone would be able to query that data at any given time to know where all the inventory sits. And that's what I think worries a lot of the brands and the dealers in between.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think it's an interesting way to think about like building loyalty to a brand as well. Cause once you're in there and you're talking with other owners, they're all sharing their wrist shots every day and what they're doing and new watches that they're like, it's a good way to kind of keep you in their little like ecosystem of what they're doing.
Absolutely.
And kind of build the enthusiasm around what they're doing, which I think is a fine thing as well. All right, so putting all that aside and just kind of focusing on the watches, are there any kind of small independent brands that you're paying attention to right now that you think are kind of like too under the radar?
Too under the radar. There's that guy Lecomte. I think he's French. He made a while. I think it was like a 10-piece limited edition that looked very much like the Grubel Forcey handmade. I mean, very, very poor man's version of that watch, obviously, because that thing's 750 grand and this thing was like 10.
Yeah.
But like for $10,000, it was a lot of watch.
Yeah.
I was very impressed with it. I unfortunately couldn't get one, but a buddy of mine in the tri-state area got one, so I got to try one on. Big fan. I think Shapiro out in LA is doing awesome stuff. Josh has kind of been at it. Yeah, he's been at it for, 3-4 years, and he's made quite a name for himself. He's got the Made in America thing going for him. The engine turning is spectacular. I know he's working on some in-house stuff that will come out hopefully in the next year or two. But I mean, it was a rocket ship. I remember because me and a bunch of Instagram friends placed a group order a year and a half ago for some of his watches, and it took a long time. And at the time we were like, oh, we'll probably get these watches in 3 months. And then he just got completely inundated with work, and some of the limited editions that he made were awesome. So that's cool. Yeah. He's doing really good stuff. There's this guy, Marco Longa, that has his new brand under his name, Marco Longa. He was from Long & Hein, and he left a couple years ago and started his own brand. His first watch looks pretty cool. It's like the first ever fully reversible watch where the lugs actually come out. So you can just unscrew the lugs, reverse the watch, stick the lugs back in. And so you can actually wear the watch on both sides. I think that's a pretty cool, it also has the first ever shock indicator in a mechanical watch, which I don't know how useful that will be, but it's something new. So I think that's cool.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, look, there's a lot of guys and girls I think out there starting to do some really cool stuff, and it's great. It's great to see that. Like, that brings me back to the days of when I first got into watches, mm-hmm. and you know, it was a struggle to make ends meet to buy these things. But like, you know, you would pull every dollar from wherever, and you'd sell a couple of pieces, and you'd find a way to buy that next watch. And that's what it was all about, like the hunt, and then how are you going to pay for this thing? And when you finally got that watch, you were so f-ing happy. I just feel like that's been lost now. Everything now is about playing some sort of game with the AD, and you know, them trying to bundle some shit, or you having to buy stuff you don't even want. Like, yeah. it's a mind. And I think that's taken away from it. But every time I see a small independent doing something really cool, and you know that you can contact them and they're going to make a watch for you, and there's no free anywhere, it's just a straight happy transaction on both sides. I yearn for those days, and that's why I continue to support the independents.
Yeah, especially when it comes to guys like Max, to go back to him. I mean, talking to him and talking about what inspires him and why he does what he does, it kind of like puts things into a better perspective, I think. At least it does for me. It's easy to kind of go down these holes, and then you kind of just like feel shitty about the whole thing. But you talk to the right people, and then it's like, oh yeah, that's what kind of drew me into this in the first place. And I think about that a lot in my own collection of, you know, what direction do I want this to go? And getting watches that kind of bring you a different kind of joy, other than just the fact that like, oh, I was able to get one. But like, the watch itself also brings you joy in the process.
Well, you know, the other thing that, you know, for 10 years I've worn nice watches, and I've worn them around the world when I travel, and I've never one time felt unsafe wherever I went. And now, for the first time over the holidays, I'm in LA. I just picked up the titanium perpetual from AP, and I remember every morning as I'm stepping out of my hotel room, I think to myself, where am I going to be? Where am I going to sit? Am I going to be outdoors where my arm's going to be exposed? Is there a chance that I'm going to get robbed? Mm-hmm. And it's so unfortunate that for me, the joy in watches was the fact that they were essentially wearable pieces of art. And I've never been an art guy in the traditional sense of hanging things on my wall. The fact that I could wear these things that I consider to be pieces of art was most of the joy.
Yeah.
And the fact that I now have to think so hard about what I wear, depending on where I'm going to go and the multiple stops I'm going to make that day. It's a true travesty that it has come to this, but that's how much money is at stake with these watches now, that if you're wearing APRM, and even ironically, my Urwerk, because it has the tonneau shape, the 220, from 10 feet away, it looks like an RM. There have been people who don't know much about watches that have seen me wearing my Urwerk, and they ask me if that's a Richard Mille. Mm-hmm. And so now I can't even wear my damn Urwerk out because someone's going to think it's a Richard Mille. I'm going to get my arm chopped off over some shit that I shouldn't even have been getting my arm chopped off.
And then bring your arm back with the watch. Place. Oh, sorry. I thought it was I thought it was an RM. Here you go, buddy. No hard feelings.
You know, and so, I mean, this was one of the reasons why a year ago, me and a couple of the guys in the community started, you know, Wax Insurance. Was I couldn't get insurance on my watch collection, because it was, I'm a millennial, I don't own my own home. And they were like, well, you don't own your own home and you don't own any cars to bundle with this, we can't insure your watches. And so that was sort of the impetus for us to start Wax. And now, you know, we insure hundreds of collectors in the community. And it's become a real problem. Like, I just had a massive heavy duty safe installed in my home. That thing weighs like 2,000 pounds. It took like 9 months to get my building to approve safe to be put in, but that's what it's come to. Like, I got to have that high security of safe. I got security cameras. I've got monitored burglar alarm, and I take great care of everything. But whether it's in my home or now on the street, like, I feel like if I don't have insurance, I'm in deep trouble, versus literally for the first 9 years of my collecting, I never thought twice about insurance. I was like, nothing's going to happen. I'm good. I take care of everything and we're good. But now it's getting, there's too much money at stake.
Yeah. So. That's like a very adult thing to have to do. Think about insurance. Right. Yeah. All right. NYC watch guy. We've talked a lot about your Medium blog. Where can people go to find you on Instagram and on the internet to read your thoughts?
Instagram obviously is NYC Watch Guy, and then I think it's medium.com/NYC Watch Guy, or just, you know, Google NYC Watch Guy Medium together and it'll come up. I also post the link in my bio every time I write a new article. It's been a while. I've actually been detoxing off of the internet and in Instagram in particular over the last four weeks. I haven't posted anything, which for me, like, as someone who's been so active in the community for the last 5 to 7 years, to have not posted anything for an entire month, you would not believe the number of messages I've gotten from people asking if I'm dead. I'm worried people are going to put an Amber Alert out on me.
It's nice to take a break, right? After a while. I do that frequently. God,
I cannot tell you how happy I have been for the last month to not have gone on Instagram, not mindlessly scrolled for hours, not had to comment on things, not have to find content to post, and then wait for the dopamine hit of getting likes and comments. And like, all of that went away, and it was so cathartic for a month. I don't know how long I'm going to keep it up, but it has been great. And honestly, like I said, all these things, like the watch world became increasingly toxic over the last 6 to 12 months with just the amount of money at stake, the number of people coming in, the games being played, people trying to screw each other over to try and get an allocation. Like, so much crap happened that for me over the holidays, like, I went out west, my parents were here, and I just said, I'm not going to go on Instagram. And for me, that's insane to think that I could do it. I didn't think I'd be able to do it. But it's now been, you know, I think we're coming up on 30 plus days almost. I'm pretty proud of myself, to be honest.
Well, good for you. Glad to hear that you're doing okay. And yeah, it's good to get away from all this. I poke into the Rolex forums every now and again to see what's going on. I went on the public forum of the Rolex forum the other day, and literally every other thread is investment level, but, you know, is Daytona going to do this? Is this worth it? What is it? I mean, almost nothing was about just, you can sense the frustration with the old timers there, I'm sure. But anyways, we all need it. And I appreciate you coming on the podcast to show everybody what you've been up to and talk about the medium. I hope you're able to keep it up because it's a lot of fun to read.
I will do that. I appreciate you guys saying that. It's always good to know that somebody's reading the crap I'm putting out there. So as long as people read it, I'll keep writing it.
All right, definitely.
It's great.
All right, NYC Watch Guy, thanks so much for taking the time to come on the Worn and Wild podcast. We appreciate it, and hopefully we'll see you around.
See you guys soon.
All right, thanks for listening. Until next time, take care.